Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history.
General Petraeus switched into the role of commander of Afghanistan here about 5 weeks ago, and General McChrystal stepped down. When we look back at history, can we find something that was similar to this, or is this a unique situation?
Well, it's a unique situation in that this is one of those non-major wars that the United States has been involved in, you know, since World War II. And so the unusual has become the norm. And in that respect, you have to keep in mind that in the military, the highest, the best, so to speak, type of command is a combat command. I mean, there have been past situations where, you know, higher ranking officers have offered to take a demotion in order to get a combat command. General Eisenhower during World War II made no secret of the fact that he was unhappy, you know, with his supreme command of Allied forces and not getting a combat command, because he never did get a combat command throughout his entire career. He thought he was cursed in that respect, but he got his orders and he carried them out. So in this case, as far as, you know, within, you know, the generals in the U.S. Army, they looked at what happened to Petraeus as, in effect, a promotion, because he was going back and getting another combat command. And that's where you basically get to do what you spent your whole life preparing for. CENTCOM, in peacetime, is the closest you're going to get to a combat command, because you're basically ready. You have combat forces at your beck and call, and you make the plans, and you make all the preparations. If a combat does work out, you're the guy on the spot. You get first dibs at, you know, whatever hard decisions have to be made. But in this case, we have two wars, well, one winding down in Iraq. And the big one right now is Afghanistan, and Petraeus has got it. So it was certainly not a demotion, at least not to a four-star general.
Now, we have seen throughout history firing of generals, or at least putting them on the bench temporarily, as they did with George Patton. But during World War II, there were a number of generals that were relieved, as there were in the Civil War. So that situation where a general is relieved of command is not unusual.
No, and in fact, the pattern in the 20th century was that in the opening stages of the war, most generals would get fired, because the military has had always had a difficult time throughout history in determining, you know, which guy who makes a great general in peacetime is equally effective in wartime. And nobody, at least in the 20th century, has come up with a way of doing that. So basically, actually, it was so bad in World War I that it stuck in everybody's mind. So General Marshall, the supreme commander of U.S. Armed Forces before World War I, World War II, and throughout World War II, in 1940, I believe it was, he dismissed dozens of senior generals because they basically reviewed their records, and based upon what happened in World War I, they decided these guys, not a chance, that they're going to succeed in combat. And they basically carefully went through the records of a lot of subordinate, you know, lower ranking officers to try and find the guys who basically had what turned out to be the right stuff in World War I. And this was generally successful. There weren't nearly as many American generals relieved in the opening battle, the American battles in World War II, as there were in World War I, and especially, you know, throughout, you know, all the armies in World War I. I mean, in French Army, I think I had the statistics in one of my books. It was horrendous. You know, I think the majority of division commanders got canned, most of the corps commanders, and so on. So this is by no means unusual. What the U.S. Army has done since Vietnam, especially, and this you can find in my Getting It Right book, the one I did with the Colonel, you know, Ray Macedonia. The Army has basically done what General Marshall did. In fact, they looked at what, you know, General Marshall did very carefully during the reforms of the 70s and 80s. And they have tried and generally succeeded. For example, the guy that McChrystal replaced was, you know, one of these guys that was, you know, selected and selected and scrutinized, and he was considered a competent commander, and he was. And it was pointed out when he was relieved that this was no, you know, bad reflection on him. It was just felt that when they looked around, this guy McChrystal is even better. In other words, the Army had a much better bench, you know, coming out of after Vietnam, you know, after the reforms of the 70s, 80s, and going into the 90s. They were much better at selecting guys who were at least competent. And occasionally you find a guy who's exceptional, which was Petraeus. And McChrystal, I think if they kept him in there, because he was doing a very good job over there. He was taking a lot of heat. And I suppose we're supposed to wait and get into this later, but let me say it now. He got a raw deal, but I think, you know, the president and his crew wanted McChrystal out because McChrystal was a little too outspoken. McChrystal was basically saying things that you, I guess you only read in strategy page.
Right.
and our track record is pretty damn good, compared to everybody else. You know, big problem is corruption, training a Afghan military, modern military is an extremely difficult task, you know, most of the population's illiterate, tribal mentality, et cetera, et cetera. Ask anybody who's any GI, any soldier or Marine who's been over there training Afghans, and my God, be prepared to sit down and spend hours and buy the guy a lot of drinks, because it'll go on and on and on. But it's basically, we sum it up very succinctly time and again in strategy page. That it requires unique tactics, and that's why they brought in McChrystal. His background was special operations, you know, dealing with situations like this.
Right.
But at the same time, he wasn't a specialist in special operations. He had just commanded a lot. I mean, he spent a lot of, he'd gone through all the training and what have you, but he'd also had a good background in the Army in general, so to speak. So he was a guy that the regular Army, who were always a little suspicious of special forces because they are a little strange, you know, could respect. And he also had, you know, the communications with the special force, special operations community. And he was bringing that all together. But he's basically making enemies back in Washington because they didn't have a clue.
Right. In part, the relief of McChrystal could probably be, if we looked at it historically, could be closely compared to Patton, because Patton was not relieved because of his command abilities, but
because
was relieved
of his mouth.
Because of his mouth, yeah.
Yeah.
Austin, you know, what will happen to McChrystal? Where will he go? What will he do?
Well, I'm not certain. I mean, I'm
going to make a lot of money giving speeches.
Well, okay, Jim. I mean, that we did. I think he was, Dan's thrust of Dan's question is where does he go within the service? And I believe he's already decided he's going to go ahead and retire. I think the man has an extraordinary future, and not just giving speeches, but I mean, as Jim outlined, his resume is quite impressive. And
I wouldn't be surprised if he were brought back to Afghanistan as a civilian consultant.
You know, that's a possibility.
Let's get that on record right here, and maybe start a betting pool.
just for what it's worth, this has dawned on other people too. It's Jim just saying it in public, you know, on this, because he really does have a grasp of the intricacies of a counterinsurgency operation. Now, look, let's pick on one of the issues that is most controversial. That was a rules of engagement that McChrystal promulgated in Afghanistan, and that Rolling Stone article, which Dan, you know, I mean, you read the column I wrote after
right.
I was impressed by that article. It reeked with the typical Rolling Stone insider macho. I thought the writer, even though I understand he spent some time doing military related reporting and had it deployed, it sounded like a wannabe, in the sense, I want to be around all these real heroes and I'm cool and they've taken me in, but I'm going to show you how potty mouth reality is. And that's appropriate to doing an article on Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead doing acid, but it wasn't appropriate to a high level combat zone command. So McChrystal's got some responsibilities with that, but there was a poignant, I think it was about three paragraphs, may have been four, where McChrystal is talking to some young enlisted soldiers about the rules of engagement. And those are really worth reading, because the soldiers say to him, you know, our lives are out there and we're under fire. And he says, I know that. He says, sometimes you got to, essentially what McChrystal says, you're going to have to trust me as the general in chain of command and see that there are larger issues. Now, that said, I mean, what he says is correct. What the young soldiers say is exactly right, because the rules of engagement increased risk to young American and NATO soldiers in serving with the International Security Force in Afghanistan. Risk went up. What he was gambling on in the aggregate, psychologically, psychological battlefield would ultimately be more dominant than the military tactical engagement, was that we'll lower civilian casualties. Folks are going to understand this, and the Taliban themselves, this doesn't appear in that article, but it appears on strategy page all the time, the Taliban are some of the bloodiest individuals on the group, their bloodiest group of bloody individuals on the planet. They kill fellow Pashtuns. They kill fellow Muslims. They just kill and kill and kill, and the locals know it. It's one reason why in the past few months, and we've had material up on this on the strategy page as well, you have seen locals organizing self-defense militia forces, not to protect themselves from the Afghan army, but to protect themselves from the Taliban. This is encouraged, of course, by NATO and the Afghan government, and at the same time, it is a response to the deadly, murderous behavior of the Taliban. And back in what McChrystal was after is, I want the people to see this difference. I'm going to take this risk as an American commander, and yes, largely with American soldiers, not just solely, British, Canadian, and everybody else as well. The deal is, he did not have sufficient time to find out whether he was right or wrong. He wasn't in command long enough. I think this is an example of a couple of the things Jim was saying about McChrystal's thinking and his approach. That part of that little Rolling Stone article was darn good. The rest of it was, you know, salacious garbage. And I think I've already said it enough. Heck, I hope somebody from Rolling Stone hears this and said, hey, let's go find Jerry Garcia's corpse and do the same kind of article. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, speaking of impressive resumes, Petraeus's is enormous. I mean, the guy probably has more combat command than anybody that's at his level right now, having gone through the original Iraq War and then having commanded basically throughout the second Iraq War.
Yeah, and the other big advantage he has, you know, he's a smart guy and is what they call an original thinker. Now, that in hindsight, you know, as a military historian, you know, it doesn't seem, you know, to make, you know, the great captains of antiquity a geniuses, but what they tended to do was more than anybody else, they made the right decision at the right time. I mean, anything that Petraeus did when he took over in 2007 was not unique, was not something that hadn't been suggested before. But he understood that the time is now, the time is right. In other words, as we've been reporting here for years in the strategy page, the problem in Iraq always was that the Sunni Arab minority, which was 20% of the population when Saddam fell, it's less than 15% now, and there's a reason why, they thought that if they ran a terror campaign of utter ruthlessness, they could take control of the country again. Now, that's utterly, you know, absurd, you know, to Western minds. But to Arab minds, that sort of thing makes sense, which is something most Americans, most Westerners don't understand. They think differently over there. Of course, what I've been saying for decades is all those foreigners think differently, and some of them think very differently. And until you get on their, you know, on their wavelength and look at things from their perspective and their way of thinking. Of course, us as people who've designed, you know, war games over the years, historical simulations, we understand that you can't have a historical simulation that works unless you basically have both sides fairly honestly represented. And that means, and that's why people like to play these simulations, because they basically get into a foreign, you know, way of thinking, oh, this is how I have to operate. This is what I'm up against. This is what I have to do, you know, to stay alive on my own side. Well, in Iraq, a Sunni could not stay alive unless they signed on for this suicide campaign against the majority of Iraqis and, of course, the coalition, foreign coalition of troops in Iraq. What Petraeus looked at when he took over was, what is the attitude towards among the Sunni population? Because that had been monitored. There were various ways. I mean, we've reported about the geeks with guns, you know, many times. And Austin, you worked with them when you were over there. They were keeping tabs on this. And Petraeus was told, look, the Sunni, you know, for the last year or so, the Iraqi Al-Qaeda and their Sunni Arab allies, Iraqi allies, have been basically making war on many of the tribal chiefs who have basically been losing faith in this idea of taking back, you know, control of the country. And if you make them a deal, that, you know, make them an offer they can't refuse, so to speak, and that offer mainly was, look, we'll hire a lot of your young guys who you have trouble controlling because they're out of work, and we will guarantee your safety, at least as long as we're here, will you switch sides? And most of them, once a number of the major tribes, you know, decided to go over, as it were, as the Sons of Iraq, whatever they call themselves, to defend the country, it snowballed. And before you know it, 90% of the tribal, you know, leadership had basically told Al-Qaeda, all right, you're trying to strong-arm us, we're not on your side anymore. And bingo, you know, within a year, the violence fell 90%. And Petraeus was hailed as a, you know, a visionary, a great victor. But basically what he did, he was smart enough to, because he'd been there before, as Austin pointed out, he's got more combat experience than anybody else in Iraq. He knew where the trend, what the trends were and what direction they were going in. And when he stepped into command, he says, okay, what are our options? Who's doing what these days? And when he saw the numbers on, you know, Iraqi, you know, the Sunni Arab, you know, leaders, it said, well, now it's time to make them the offer. Because they've made the offer before, and they'd only gotten nibbles. But this time, everybody just bit. And that was the end of it. Now, Afghanistan is a different situation. Yeah, you have tribes. Yeah, you have the religious fanatics, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a similar situation in that there are opportunities. The crystal saw them. And I suspect that Petraeus sees the same opportunities. Now, he may change the rules of engagement, and the only reason I say that is because there are two things going on with the rules of engagement. One, a lot of Iraqis don't like the rules of engagement because it basically allows the Taliban to get away. They use human shields. And they say, look, hey, we live in a rough part of the world. We'd rather you kill, you know, the Taliban, even if it means some of us getting zapped in the crossfire, than letting those bastards get away because they're just going to come back and try and kill us again anyway. So as far as, I mean, the Afghans may be illiterate, but they can do the basic math. And they realize that their lives are better in the long run if there are more dead, you know, Taliban. And so Petraeus may ease up on that. The other consideration that most people ignore, but which we point out in the strategy page, is that almost all the violence is concentrated in two provinces, Kandahar and Helmand. Helmand being the source of most of the world's heroin supply. Now that's important because that's where most of Afghanistan's, you know, underground economy, you know, money comes from, billions of dollars a year. This is what's keeping the Taliban going because they have a payroll. People, very few people, work for the Taliban for nothing, if only because they have families, you know, to take care of them, what have you. The Taliban pays, and they pay using drug money because they basically provide security for the drug gangs, or at least try to. Now, Petraeus and McChrystal's plan was to go after the drug gangs and basically to try and give those pushtuns in those two provinces, which, by the way, only contain about 8% of the population of Afghanistan. So we're basically talking about a small part of the country is where most of the fighting and most of the headlines are coming from. But this part of the country is very different. First of all, they're beholden to the drug gangs. It's making a lot of people rich. At the same time, it's making the drug gangs and their allies, the Taliban, the strongest independent armed force in the country. They're basically warlords. Nobody likes to call them that, but that's what they are. And they are a set independent power which has a very small power base. The latest opinion surveys they ran in Afghanistan, which I think we've already reported, showed that about 70% of the population in Kandahar and Helmand are against the foreign troops. Well, of course they are, and for two reasons. One, it's because the drug business is a major source of wealth, whether you're making the drugs or simply, you know, selling stuff to the guys who are. And secondly, if you're not against the foreign troops, the Taliban will kill you. You know, so granted, in their heart of hearts, they might be against the Taliban, but boy, you don't want to show that openly so the Taliban can detect that. Now, as Austin points out, a lot of the tribes throughout the country where the Taliban are trying to spread, you know, so to speak, are forming these militias. In many non-Pushtun parts of Afghanistan, like in the north, remember 60% of the population is not Pushtun. The Taliban doesn't even bother to try and get in, because the Uzbeks or the Tajiks or whatever, they will immediately come out in force and kill them. They find Pushtuns with guns roaming around, they will be shot on sight. And this doesn't get reported, because, you know, no violence is no news. So you don't hear any reporting about the majority of the country, which is basically at peace, as much peace as Afghanistan can muster, but by Afghanistan's standards, peace. So the main problem is in this one small part of the country, and there's an opportunity here for a similar deal that was used in Iraq, because a lot of the Pushtuns don't want any part of all this violence. In other words, the Taliban are a minority within a minority. They came originally from tribes around Kandahar and Helmand. That's where the original leadership and most of the, you know, the key people in the Taliban came from tribes, and they are trying to impose their tribal customs, their will, as it were, on all the other tribes, in all the other Pushtun tribes in southern Afghanistan, and all the tribes throughout the country. And that does not work. It didn't work in the 90s, and it's not working today. And most people don't understand that, because that doesn't get reported. You know, it's not really a civil war, because they're so heavily outnumbered, a minority among a minority. It's very similar to what was going on in Iraq. It didn't work there. It's not going to work here.
Right. Now, one of the big challenges that Petraeus has is dealing with the Karzai government because of the corruption there and the like. And maybe his other challenge is dealing with the U.S. State Department. Do you think he's going to handle the political side of all of this?
Oh, I think Petraeus has almost all the political cards right now. I say almost. You know, events can change. There can be a leak of a video or a misstatement, or, you know, I doubt there will be another Rolling Stone type article for, you know, many moons. That could be months, years, whatever. But you don't know. Some of that's a momentary political flux. But what Obama has publicly bet. And this is odd for Obama, because he's so cagey about doing this in many ways. He's bet his personal political career as president on Petraeus. Notice I said it's on Petraeus, not on success in Afghanistan, despite what he said. So with that kind of, we began by discussing the lateral move to the combat command. The president has done that. He has given Petraeus quite an extraordinary military and political portfolio, which is why your comment, trouble with the State Department, is reasonable. And heaven knows that was when McChrystal certainly had in fighting with the State Department that was reflected in that Rolling Stone article, though I do note that there was indicated very positive thoughts about Secretary of State Clinton infighting problem there with Ambassador in Kabul, Ambassador Eikenberry. That I think Petraeus has got and I'm not sure how much time I would put on it, but he's got a window of opportunity where he's, I think, what he wants, he gets. And there's several caveats to this, but let me mention the big one, and that is the president himself. So Obama got to stick with him. I think that's a fair question to ask. My guess is right now is that he does, because of the nature of the war, Obama's long-term campaign rhetoric of the Afghanistan, quote unquote, the good war. Understand that I don't see it as a separate war from Iraq, global war on terror, but nevertheless, that's the way Obama separated it. A war we must win. And then with changes in command from to first to McChrystal and then to Petraeus, he's got time. I think Jim's in what Jim alluded to earlier, that he's going to be doing a bunch of things that McChrystal was doing. I think that's going to be accurate too.
Right. Now, one of the things that's happened is the July 2011 date is still out there. I've heard the statements coming out of the White House now are starting to say things like not withdrawal, or, you know, we're going to, they've started talking about we're going to reduce the number of troops. And it sounds like that is not going to stick as a hard, fast date.
No, they can't afford to. You can't afford to just leave Afghanistan and declare victory, because then you create another Somalia. Now, actually, what would most likely happen would actually not be another Somalia. It would be another civil war, like the one we dropped into the middle of in late 2001, you know, at the on 9/11, actually on the day before 9/11, the Al-Qaeda, working at the behest of the Taliban, had assassinated the leader of the Northern Alliance. That was the other side of the ongoing Afghan civil war. The Taliban had managed to conquer, or more or less, most of the country, but parts of the north were still holding out. Now, in the subsequent 9 years, the Northern Alliance has become much stronger. They basically control the government. They control most of the key positions. Karzai is a push to him, and he became leader of the government mainly because the deal, the understanding in Afghanistan for several centuries now has been that to keep the peace, the head of state, the king or whatever, will be a Pushtun. And the Pushtuns will have basically disproportionate influence in the government. They are 40%. But what makes them so powerful is there are three times as many Pushtuns across the border in Pakistan. There is a Pushtun stand, so to speak. So the other groups in Afghanistan, which comprise 60% of the population, said, okay, we understand you have a lot of friends across the border. We don't want to mess with that. We are outnumbered if it comes down to a war between us and the Pushtuns. But since 9/11, the Pushtuns in Pakistan are at war with the Pakistani government, which has never happened before. That's important to understand. When India and Pakistan were created in 1947, they continued the same rules in what they call the tribal territories, in other words, where most of the Pushtun live, that the British had followed. Basically, we will leave you alone. You can run your own affairs. Just don't raid into the, you know, the lowlands where most of the population lives, and we won't come with our armies and mess with you. It was, in effect, a truce between the Pushtun tribes, which can be pretty nasty, and the majority of the people in the lowlands in Pakistan. Now, that has been broken. The Pakistani government has been trying to break that for years. They've been doing it slowly by basically setting up governments in the major cities, which were more under the control of the national government. So basically it was like an ink spot strategy. Major towns and the cities like Peshawar and whatnot, they basically were under the control of the central government. But the countryside was still controlled by the tribes. But what's been going on for the last 20 years is there's been a generational change in the Pushtun tribes, at least especially in Pakistan, where a new generation is coming up that doesn't want to do things the old way. Now, a lot of these new guys went over to the Taliban and say, hey, this is a shortcut to power. You know, these old fogies still have a lot of clout. They still have a lot of guns, you know, who will do their bidding. But if I run with the Taliban, these guys are ruthless. They're crazy. You know, they're my kind of people. And I can become, you know, basically I can take over the tribal territories. The Pakistani government opposed that. They did it very discreetly because you do not want to get the tribes riled up. You don't want them boiling over into the major population areas of Punjab and Sindh. But once the once we invaded Iraq and basically declared war on Islamic radicalism, the Islamic radicals in Pakistan noticed that the Pakistani government had sided with the Americans and said, all right, we're at war with the Pakistani government. That was a big mistake. You know, like Hitler declaring war on the United States after Pearl Harbor. That's how it will be understood in the future. Because at that point, the Pakistanis had no choice. Their slow but steady plan for taking over the tribal territories was enormously speeded up. And for the last 2 years, they've been at war in the tribal territories. Now, they haven't overrun the entire place. They've been very careful. They've tried to make deals with the tribal leaders because they know the Pushtun tribes are basically a bunch of armed, heavily armed, easily agitated, short-tempered tribesmen who have been basically the bane of the existence of the lowlanders for thousands of years. And they understand this. We have to understand this. But what that means for Afghanistan is that the Pushtuns in Afghanistan can no longer depend on their kinsmen in Pakistan to come to their aid. That's a big difference. And nobody understands that better than the non-Pushtun majority in Afghanistan. Because what they are basically telling the Pushtun now, that if the Americans leave and you decide to, you know, come and take Kabul, it's not going to be so easy. There will be a bloody civil war in Afghanistan if we just up and leave. And we're probably going to have to come back because what's going to fuel the Pushtun, you know, war is heroin.
Right.
People are going to start yelling and screaming. Because, I mean, it's already being noticed. Where's a lot of heroin coming from? It's coming from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Dan, I think that's
it's a good place to end, Austin. And it's a good place to end, right?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm going to say, because the thing is that Jim and I have touched on this in what's going on in Pakistan several times. It runs contrarian to a lot of the coverage of it. Huge topic. I think we ought to pick it up next time.
Yeah, that sounds good. We've run out of time. And, boy, to tell you the truth, gentlemen, this is one of the most interesting discussions I think we've had in a long time, and a lot of really good material, so I appreciate it. And we'll talk to you next time.